Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With a flash of that famous red head, it was all different. A new type of Rangers hero had arrived. Many before him had run to take their Ibrox acclaim, resplendent in royal blue, but very few had been a Roman Catholic, and none had been a former Celtic hero who had revelled in antagonising Rangers. Only a year before, Morris Johnson had stated in his autobiography, "Let me just spell out where I stand here. I'm a Celtic man through and through, and so dislike Rangers because they're a force in Scottish football and a threat to the club I love. But more than that, I hate the religious policy which they still maintain. Why won't they sign a Roman Catholic? I hate religious bigotry, and the Rangers fans have always tried to single me out in Old Firm games." Now, thousands were saluting him around all four sides of Ibrox Stadium as he scored his first competitive goal for his new club, their club. But what was their club anymore? Season 89-90 was another significant chapter in the story of modernisation and the acute friction that this inevitably produces. The Johnson signing was unquestionably the standout narrative thread, as it didn't just nudge the door towards a new modern player market ajar, instead it blew off its hinges, creating existential mayhem for fans on both sides of the divide. Rangers would never make a more controversial signing again, and in doing so ease the path towards the modern multinational footballing world that the next decade would epitomise, one which would end with an Italian treble-winning Rangers captain. It was, as both Graeme Souness and David Murray have since admitted, something that simply had to be done. But this is also the season of a lesser-known tale of modernity, one that didn't quite come to fruition, but nevertheless tells us so much about the challenges that Rangers faced in trying to move forward in 1989. That first Johnson goal, the only goal on a 1-0 win over Aberdeen in the September, neatly encapsulated something else that was going on at the time. On the face of it, it was a very typical goal of the era. Ball out wide, cross into the crowded penalty box, and a header past a helpless goalkeeper. But there was a wee bit more to it than that. It was scored by one major summer signing and assisted by the other, Trevor Stephen, and both players representing something of the modern themselves. They were both classy, all-round footballers, not easily pigeonholed into stereotypical roles. Stephen's cross was delightful, but without natural pace, he was never an out-and-out winger, and Johnson's header was not the powerful target man bullet, but a clever, almost sneaky goal as he ghosted into the space between Willie Miller, Alex McLeish and Stuart McKimmie and deftly let the ball do all the work. In this season, Souness would give up his target man approach and he would not seek as much width as he had previously. After a painful lesson, he would also soon come to the obvious conclusion that building a successful style in Scotland is not easily compatible with creating a successful formula on a European stage that was shedding its English influence and moving towards the skill and flexibility of Serie A. He knew that change was required and was initially willing to experiment. Crucially, he had the freedom to do so. That Johnson goal gave Rangers their first win of the season after four games, but incredibly didn't lift them from the bottom of the Scottish Premier Division. More importantly, there were only 2 points between bottom and top, and that congestion, as the chasing pack continued to cut each other down, would provide the breathing space for such tactical risks. To what extent he made the most of that opportunity is another question. This was a season of necessary, if unpopular, change, both on and off the park. If Rangers showed as much bravery and foresight with the former as they did with the latter, history might have been very different indeed. To discuss the summer of 1989 and the start of that tumultuous season, I'm joined by Andy McGowan. How are we, Andy?
I'm good, man. Thanks for asking me back on.
Pleasure. And from Athens, Greece, it's John Cowden. How are you, John?
I'm well, thank you. Glad to be back, talking positivity.
Well, indeed, there's a lot to be positive about. Perhaps, I'm not sure how many people shared that feeling in the summer of 1989. It's certainly the start of the season, which we'll come to. I can imagine Twitter was around after that second game. Gents, can I take you back to a World Cup final that Scotland are in control of, only to completely mess up and lose in penalties? Of course, FIFA's Under-16 tournament, which was held in Scotland in the June of 89. I was at Hampden for that opening ceremony. My dad was playing in the brass band doing the national anthems. 6,000 people joined me at Hampden. Scotland played Ghana, a 0-0 draw. Pele was there as an ambassador. I shook his hand, which was, I think, the highlight of his day. But the tournament grew in the imagination of the public. I think the semi-final between Scotland and a Portugal side containing Luis Figo in the semi-final at Tynecastle had to be delayed because, you know, the amount of people that just wanted in. It was quite the event. Of course, Saudi Arabia would win with their incredibly old players. FIFA didn't investigate those claims, but they were happy to get involved in what was becoming the Scottish transfer story of the summer, with Celtic and Mo Johnson in bitter dispute over the legitimacy of any signed documents. Sepp Blatter said that we have a signed agreement dated May the 10th saying that the player would be transferred from Nantes to Celtic as from July 1st. And we also have a signed agreement by Maurice Johnson on May 12th, stating that he would sign for Celtic on July 1st. We have studied these documents and consider them to be binding for the parties involved, with a wee caveat, unless the parties mutually agree to rescind the existing contracts. Bill McMurdo, guys, said, that's not true, we'll go to the European courts, all we've got here is a letter of intent, really, and Celtic were under pressure. John, if they'd paid the 700 grand that they were still due, they would have the player's contract, they would have the player's registration. They could then sell him, again, to a team that actually he wanted to play for, perhaps. But, you know, in terms of controlling the game, you know, they would have that. Billy McNeil was adamant. He implored the Celtic chairman, Jack McGinn, to please do this. But at the end of June, he and some other Celtic directors were on holiday, and Jack McGinn pulled out. The media reaction, quite supportive. Like, this is a bit of a nonsense, this. Let him, you know, choose his next club, someone he actually wants to play for. What they didn't know, of course, is that that club had been chosen for a wee while. But then, before we get to the Rangers stuff, do you remember the deterioration of this deal?
Yeah. I mean, I think it actually peaked just before the Scottish Cup final, which gave them a boost. But then after that, I mean, it was at the time, I seem to recall, and this might be a fake memory, it was about who was paying tax or not paying tax, but you could see he wasn't going there. He didn't want to play for them. And if a player doesn't want to play for you, okay, you can take him, you can put him in the reserves, but they ain't going to spend £1 million or whatever plus to put somebody in the reserves or hold them. You just could see it was just a farce, and it was the way it took so long, and McNeil saying he's our player. And I mean, they were having a kind of, as indeed they did all of that era, it felt like they were playing out a soap opera in the papers. You know, villains, and it was all in that emotional level of Celtic. And you know, but you could see it was coming. It just seemed to take forever to get to the point of actually it's not happening. But it was no surprise when it got to that point, was my recollection. because pretty much as soon as he'd won the cup, it all began to unravel. And it was, you know, McNeil and McMurdo were at the extremes of the thing. And I think the Celtic board just thought, well, we don't have that much money. We're not going to buy somebody we don't like. Probably also thinking, well, he's not going to sign for anybody else in Scotland, so no claim, no foul.
Andy, I discussed this also with Alan and David in the last show, how worried my dad was the week before the end of the season when it looked like Johnson was going there, because he was a very accomplished and a very much improved player with his 2 years in Nantes. We knew that because he had demonstrated that for Scotland, a huge part in getting Scotland at this point as good as close, as good as, you know, sealed to Italia 90. Was there any sense of relief that this thing was falling through and in such farcical fashion, which of course rival fans always seem to enjoy?
Oh, 100%. I mean, the signing of Johnson for Celtic was a major coup at that time. And, you know, it's one of the ones where, as a rival fan, you're secretly scunnered, you're secretly sickened. You know, we all know that feeling when Celtic sign somebody like that. That's quite a good signing. You may not admit it, but you know it deep down, and you wouldn't mind them playing for your own team as a player. So to see it 40 bits, and in the manner it did, was at that point classic Celtic board. And we know the difference between what our club was trying to do. We spoke about it in previous pods, about the kind of forward-thinking vanguard of British football we were as a club, and how Celtic were just, you know, desperately trying to stay relevant in terms of the commercial aspect and the power play that was going on in Scottish football. So to see that 40 bits was a double delight, because you knew they'd lost a really good player that would have made a hell of a difference to them, but also it kind of put them back to square one in terms of credibility as a football club and board. So aye, delighted, man, to be honest with you.
Yeah. You might have heard me in the last show mention Graham Souness's A Manager's Diary that he wrote with Ken Gallagher that covered ostensibly 88-89, the season, but they extended that to include the summer of 1989. Oh dear. I wonder if he would come to us, he writes. Now there's a thought. Certainly was, but one that he had weeks ago, because, you know, the deal was very much in fruition, not on the 1st of July, as the book states. Clearly done just to... this was published in November, I think. Things were still pretty tense, so they had to kind of fib. But you know, the truth of the deal's come out obviously since then. Speak to Campbell Ogilvie. You grew up in the house of a GP, so he was well trained in keeping his mouth shut with things he'd heard. But yeah, the deal was done. But Rangers still needed to get Maurice Johnson to register. They needed to sign his league forms. And that happened in the back of a car, as many people will know, on the 7th of July. Ogilvie and Alan Montgomery, who was the CEO of Rangers at the time, they agreed to meet Johnson and McMurdo in the old car park of the Royal Scot Hotel in Edinburgh. It's no longer there. And the British Rail van with all these workers in their orange tabards having their lunch right in front of them. But Johnson got out from one car into the other with his baseball cap and glasses, and no one saw a thing. And then Monday, 10th of July, it was all announced. John, the nation's footballing media struggled to comprehend it. Johnson and McMurdo were in Ibrox at 5 a.m. as soon as didn't want anyone seeing them. They were hiding in the toilet. Of course, George Souter, Doddy Souter, and his friend, they were overheard chatting at the urinals. The urinals, knowing there was a signing going to be announced because the Blue Room was all prepared for it. Who are we going to sign today, his friend asked. I don't care who we sign as long as it's not that Maurice Johnson, or words to that effect. He may have used some others. Yeah, John, can you remember where you were for this JFK moment?
Yeah, I was at work in British Steel, and it came through, and I wasn't happy. And it was one of those weird situations where all the Motherwell and Airdrie fans were laughing, and myself and the Celtic, the guy that ran the Celtic Supporters Club, were both sick. My me, it wasn't signing a Catholic. In fact, I thought we already had in Trevor Francis. It wasn't that. It was, and it still kind of holds until this date. I didn't actually believe that anyone brought up in that kind of sort of family. And I had read his autobiography because I was friendly with the Celtic supporter and he gave it the previous year and it was hilarious. And I'd seen what he'd written, I'd seen how he'd played against us. I couldn't quite grasp that he would be able to give his all for us. Not play for the jersey, but play for the money. And therefore, yeah, I did struggle at that early stage because I couldn't see how he was going to give his all for us. And, you know, Michael O'Halloran being the classic example of how it tends to go, I would argue, and let's face it, in the 30-odd years since Morris signed, I mean, how many from that background have come and signed for us? Generally, they don't. You know, the stories of Ray Houghton, John Collins. There is so much pressure, both as individual and their families and the community, that it took a very brave man. Now, he made me eat my words very rapidly. I didn't stop going, didn't boo him or anything. But it was, particularly in the early first two, three games, there was probably a keener interest in terms of, you know, is he going to be a passenger just here for the money, or is he going to give it all for the cause? And you couldn't fault him. You couldn't fault the guy. But, I mean, the initial reaction on that Monday, I think it started coming through about 11 o'clock. It might have been in the Sun, but nobody actually believed it. I don't know. But it would be 11, 12, it started coming through in the radios. And I just thought, he's never going to work for us. I could remember him coming off that League Cup final. Another fight, where was it? Ali Dawson, where Dawson gets sent off. What he'd say. And you just thought, how is this going to work? I mean, that was... And people say, oh, it was bigotry. I think for the vast majority, we spoke a lot in the bus and everything. The vast majority of guys, it was, is he going to, you know, give his all?
Yeah.
And I think there was some huge doubts about that because, yeah.
Andy, we've done a show on this the 30 year since Mojo is there in the archives, but for those who may have missed that a few years ago, your memories of the 10th of July, 1989.
See, in Willy Wonka, when Wee Charlie wins the ticket and he runs all the way home as fast as he can without stopping, that was me running to the local spa to get the newspaper, because I can't actually remember how we found it. I think it was on the radio or somebody phoned the house or something, and it was quite early in the day and it was summer holidays, and I ran to the spa and the Sun had it, but Daily Record didn't, famously. And I've got to say, I was, well, you know, 12, 13 year old. The religious side, I knew, I understood. You know, my father came from a background that I was well versed, but I saw it as a triumph. I really, really saw it as the biggest kick in the balls you could ever give Celtic because of what had went the weeks before when they're parading them. And as I say earlier on, we knew there was a good signing for him. He was probably the best striker in Britain, best British striker at that point in time. Yeah. So, massive triumph, couldn't wait to tell my dad. I just looked at that front page and I could not believe my eyeballs. We had a family engagement party, you know, soon, no long after that, and you know, the more bitter members of my family, uncles, stuff like that, I can remember sitting in the car with these adults and they're talking about it. And they're talking about it as if it was, you know, we're not going back. This is beyond the pale. This is just off the scale, kind of traitorous action by the football club. And I remember thinking, they're mental. They don't know what's coming next, because I knew he'd be a good player for us. So, of course, always forgotten when he put the ball in the back of the net a couple of months later.
Yeah. I mean, I took my lead from my dad. And I, you know, like you, I knew what the story was here. This was not a normal signing. But at, 8 years old, it's a footballing thing. And Mm-hmm. Rangers were getting a striker. I appreciate some of those older Rangers supporters just questioning the logistics of it, and you know this is going to be a nightmare for him, and it was. We get into that a bit later. Again, it's all in that 30th anniversary show. Every player's car's been searched for, you know, devices and all sorts. You know, get into Ibrox and whatever. And as would be the case, you know, John asked, you know, who else has done it. Neil McCann would spring to mind. The real hassle was from the other side of the city, who felt very let down, shall we say, and would take quite a bit to recover. The news footage, the interviews, I think it's an ITN broadcast, incredible stuff from outside Parkhead. The ones outside Highbrook are equally as remarkable. The boy, every summer I think about it, the guy who's come straight for his work, he's still got his welder's glasses on, I think, just to display his outrage happening at Ibrox. But despite the bigotry and despite the sectarianism angle, this is a modern signing in so many other ways. Johnson could have taken the easy route, which was going in inverted commas home, where Celtic obviously, you know, desperate to get him, not that much, so they ultimately wouldn't do the kind of deal, but that was an option. It would have been easy, it would have been safe, but he went to Rangers for money and medals, both of which he got in spades, and that's the professional footballer, the modern professional footballer right there, that will put all the kind of romantic stuff, prodigal son narrative to one side, for pure hard cash and success, because this is where Rangers were heading, and it clearly was obvious that Celtic weren't. And that's the other side to this footballing coin, that they didn't have him that season. Now, would it have papered over the cracks? It would have done so to some extent. It would have still been doing that job for sure. Jackie Jackanowski, who they did get for £500,000, kind of old-fashioned number nine, and definitely not the kind of all-round player that Mo Johnson was. That just wouldn't come close, would it? We'll see what happens to Celtic's issues or Celtic's season as a result of that. But it was, I think, just a very, very modern football signing in terms of the motivation. It's something that we're just used to now. That Rangers fan response, again, I'm sure we're all familiar with some of the news stories, John, with the wreath that was put outside Ibrox, the scarf's been burned. You got a few people pretty much set up by the press for more sensationalism. From your pals, the boys that were going on the bus, John, and more importantly, Mrs. Cowden, how did they take that? What was the chat? I mean, Andy's given us a wee bit of insight into you know, what he was hearing that summer. Did you know anyone that vowed never to go back?
Yeah, on our bus, 50 odd, I suppose, there were three, a father and son, both married to Catholics, weirdly, and another guy who'd gave up watching Rangers in the early 80s to go and see Clyde Bank. And one of them actually came back. It was his wife. It was a Catholic wife that kicked him out of the house one Saturday because he was listening to Radio Clyde. And after a year, because he was still kicking every ball. But generally, it's a wait and see. It was a bold move. It was by him predominantly. I mean, there was a kind of thing for Souness and a look at me, which, yeah, it was the right thing to do, but I think he also enjoyed the kind of limelight which came with it. But it was how is this guy going to cope? Because, as you say, the vitriol from the east end of the city. And, you know, Judas, the way McNeil was, his family would have been experiencing that. And therefore him. I mean,
his dad was a victim.
Weird kind of thing.
His dad was assaulted.
His dad was a Rangers supporter. I know. His dad was a Protestant. It turned out. I mean, it was one of these weird. I think we got a doppelganger because Mohair Mojo with Mother Teresa at Parkhead. I don't think it's the same guy that turns up as Manicured Morris with the Rangers bat at Ibrox. I mean, same player. I mean, the narrative, even the way he's dressed, the parent who appears, it's all very strange. But the amount of pressure that guy was, he burnt all bridges, let's be honest.
Yeah.
And if it hadn't worked, he couldn't have come back to Scotland at all. You know, in no way. And I know he hasn't played in any testimonials, but I'm pretty certain he'd get a better reception off the Rangers fans as opposed to those across the city who called him Judas, the former tracksuit salesman. I mean, they were furious. And never mind that season in terms of style of play. It absolutely destroyed, I think, McNeil in particular. But their psychology for 5, 6, 7 years was just, even up until now, it was blown out of the water.
Which, if we can't be naive.
And that was the joy of it. Yeah.
We can't be naive in thinking that Graeme Souness would not have been aware of the impact that they would have had on a title rival. Again, as much as this, you know, him and Murray, they agreed that this is something they had to do. Souness was, you know, adamant from day one it was going to be something he would do, and they were aware of that. But again, this specific move on that specific, you know, close season was a footballing decision, probably first and foremost, and he knew what it would give to Rangers, and he knew what it would do to Celtic, and we will see the impact of that as this season goes on. John, just while we're there, and if Andy's got anything else that he can remember, I know he's obviously a bit younger, and I'm aware going through the fanzines, going through all the editions of Follow for these 12 years has been illuminating. Shall we say, it's been very, very interesting. And I am aware, as a caveat, that maybe the social media of its day, the fanzine, not just Rangers fanzines, but just the fanzine culture in general, a bit more extreme. People have to write a letter. So they have to be really moved to bother, you know, scribbling something down, typing something up and posting it off rather than, you know, just getting their phone out and, you know, just let loose with whatever frustrations they have. The sign, the Mojo, the front cover, by the way, that first issue with the cartoon of Johnson, his Ranger strip, down on his knees in a praying position, "Forgive me, Father, for I have signed," is one of the best fanzine front covers of all time. But it's not quite one-way traffic. There's a lot of balance in there, but clearly there are quite a few that, you know, they're letting loose with their frustrations and their outrage. But it was tensions that were simmering from the first issue. First issue of Fall of All came out in the August of 88. So 2 years after this revolution started. And whilst they're enjoying the success that's coming their way, there is this tension about the shape and the running of the club, the kind of money-grabbing Thatcherite Barrow Boy Spivs, as someone called Souness and Murray, the modernisation in all elements that's taking it away from the Rangers that quite a few of them would have enjoyed in the early 80s. Not the success, but the fact that they got tickets, they went with their pals at a time and in an age where they could do that every single week, regardless of some of the dreadful results. And now tickets are scarce, or more scarce, and more expensive. European prices this season will double from last season. Season ticket prices in 87 doubled from 86. And there's a real concern about where the club is headed. A recognition that the, you know, Rangers do need the hospitality and they do need to expand all that side of it in order to get these players, in order to get, well, maybe not this player, but certainly good players to compete. But what does this mean? Is this our club anymore? And one in particular, very clear that Rangers didn't just die on 10th of July 89, it died and soon as came, because it took something away, much more of a business, more money orientated. And the phrase that keeps coming back is the Camel Coat Brigade, John, which I'm sure you're familiar with. But this idea that, where were you when we were shit, which is nothing new in football. But all these people have come back, they'll be gone when Rangers are shit again. Where were they? I don't quite get that, John. There were thousands and thousands of Rangers supporters before the early 80s. I'm presuming these aren't new faces. They are making a return, because clearly attendances were down and went back up. But I'm struggling to buy the notion that Rangers didn't appeal to people of different class, and also that it could well have been the same people in similar situations in the late 70s, but life has changed for a lot of people by 1987, 88, 89. People are more socially mobile, shall we say. Things are changing. Your experience of that, please.
I never really came across it. It was one of those weird bubbles, I would say. I'd went on the supporters bus with my grandfather, but I'd been going since I was 16 on the Partick Loyal, so 1982. And yeah, if you were in a supporters bus, or indeed you were going regularly, you didn't struggle for a ticket, even in the peak soonest years. There may have been the odd guy, you know, there might be the odd example, but generally, if you were going every week, season ticket or not, but on a supporters bus, you would get tickets. And because you'd be a well-known face as well, if somebody was struggling who you knew went every week, because you would see the people, they would get it. So I never bought into this overhyped thing. There was a classic, I wouldn't say classic in that sense, but there was a TV show just after, was it Passion Fire or something? And around, yeah. Was it Channel 4?
Channel 4.
Around 80. Yeah. And it was filmed in Roseville after Morris Jones had signed.
Yeah.
And they'll probably be shown. I went to school with some of these guys who were ranting raving. Most of them didn't go to see Rangers in the early 80s. One of them was the captain of Celtic's boys' club, who played together with Peter Grant. He was in my class at school. Nice guy, good footballer. But to be then being so outraged, and where were you? We had crowds of an average in the early 80s of 18,000. To see, you know, those 18,000, then there'd be some only turning up for the Old Firm games. Really a struggling. What was it you were able to do in the early 80s which you couldn't do later on? Because you could pick and choose your games. So if you played Aberdeen, you played Celtic, you know, home or away, or you got to a cup final, a semi-final, you got a ticket. Relatively no problem. 83, 84, League Cup, not. So generally it was the occasional supporter who could just pitch up when they fancied it and got a ticket. And that changed as it was, but most of the guys in my bus and every bus, particularly the ones that were going a long time, you know, the KP, Edinburgh Union Jack, Nick Steele or whatever, yeah, there was a bit of a price to pay, but winning regularly and absolutely blowing particularly the other end of the city out of the water, I mean, life is magnificent. And you talk about fanzine. The most read fanzine in our supporters bus on a Saturday was not The View, which was the Tins one. There was one of our pals, guy in his work was a Celtic fan, who would bring it, and they would just get past it. It was absolutely hilarious. And every sense of they were over-emotional, over-hyped. You know, I think you classed it before as pragmatism for Protestants or whatever. And that's what Morris Johnson was. He was a capitalist. I'm not playing for the jersey. I am playing for the money, and I will give you everything I've got for the money because you're a better option for my career.
Yeah.
Whereas it seemed like everybody Celtic signed, including, I think, Jack Inofsky, Albanians, whatever, would come up in a dodgy accent and say, and I always wanted to play for Celtic. And they believed it every time. Whereas we were on another level of, we know Butcher's here for the money, we know Trevor Stevens here for the money, we know they're here because we're in Europe and England aren't. And that's fine by us because it's a pure transactional thing.
Yeah,
they're giving it all. We're taking it. They get what we want. We get what we want. And it's happy days are here again.
And this is what I mean about the modernisation, Andy. This goes back to Butcher, Woods and Roberts. They're mercenaries. When the going gets tough at Rangers, they won't know what this is all about. It won't work. Certainly by 80-89, the season we've just finished, that's over. That's over now. And what John's saying is exactly right. It's not just Johnson. Some of these big names have come and done it. Yep, they're here for the money, but they're professional. So they will give absolutely everything, and they want to win things because they're professional. The playing for the jersey mythology and all that romantic bullshit, that might as well be all in Pathé News by now.
Parkhead News, actually, because they believed it.
Yeah. Andy?
Sorry, Andy.
Yeah, the country's changing. You know, and there's some people being left behind. Some people are choosing to be left behind because they're holding on to the past, and it was reflected in football, and it was probably never reflected better at that period than Rangers, certainly in Scotland. I was well tuned into the fanzine culture at that point. I was buying follow, reading it voraciously. Mm. It was becoming a bit of a centre of an underground centre of influence, you know, because some people on my bus, I was one of them, would bring on. And we felt as if we were in the know about things that the mainstream, to take a phrase, the mainstream support didn't know, because we were reading about things in there that just wasn't in the thinking of the average fan. And there was fans that were swept away with the transformation and embraced it. And then there was fans, as you say, Martin, that were in the fanzine, making their voices heard in the likes of the fanzine, where they felt disenfranchised because the camel coats was a thing. Mm. It was the prawn sandwich brigade. It's the same concept that we were talking about here, where fans felt that there was a class divide to be created amongst their own support. Now, the truth was, there always was, right? Because my papa was a fairly wealthy bookie in Govan, and he used to have a clique of pals that used to, whatever the forerunner of members club was, there just wasn't that many of them. Yeah. And then it was commercialised to the point where you had hospitality went, you know, exploded.
Yeah.
You had, season, I mean, we tickets, were talking about that.
Season ticket. You'd fewer than 2,000 season ticket holders before 86, 87. By 1992, you'd have 27,000. The East Enclosure would sing to the Copeland, you know, you can shove your season tickets up your ass. And then there was this, now, a playful to and fro, and again, nothing new in the world of football, but there was a tension there that, who are you, where have you been, and you'll be gone when soonest go is basically, when this is all over, the real Rangers will be back and it'll just be us, you know, 8,000 or whatever. But they're not getting it, and it's, things are changing and will never be the same again.
You become a fan out of time. You know, you're railing against something that is unstoppable. The thing that I remember acutely was it the Premier Club? You know, it's been rehashed several times since, where you got a tie,
yep,
you got some kind of discount at the Rangers show. It was just money for old rope as far as Rangers were concerned. But Fo bought it. You had the club deck. I mean, the club deck was the same. I remember as at that time thinking, right, hold on a minute, you paid £2,000 for the bond, but you've still got to buy the season ticket every year. So Rangers fans were it's like majors. People say, I hate majors, and then they go out and buy it because they either feel they can't miss out on it, or else they must do it, or, you know, there's some, it's the emotion of being a football fan that overrides the emotion, or the calculated emotion of a consumer. That's the difference. And so the fanzine was central to that kind of undertone. But I don't know, maybe it's the aspirational young Andy of the time. Yeah. I always thought, you know, I want to be at this side of the fence, which is, you know, reach for the stars.
Yeah.
Souness and Murray were people I admired at that point in time. And I just took it as a measure or a yardstick of how far ahead of the competition Rangers were going. That's what I saw of it.
Yeah.
But then I was young and naive.
Well, let's get
back to... I
don't
know whether Andy's actually praising me or slating me here as a, you know, an inaugural member of the Premier Club, who also then bought a debenture in the club deck, which he didn't need.
So you're an all-round sucker, John. That was you. Murray must have loved you.
Oh, there was another one for the Premier Club whereby if you stuck, was it a few hundred quid up front, you got 10% off your season ticket for 3 or 4 years and you got the name in the seat.
Yeah, it was. But this is changing.
But I was buying into it.
But I think the tie...
Put your money in.
Yeah. The tie is so...
I still got it up the stair.
Yeah, the Premier Club tie seems so... And it is. I mean, it's not particularly expensive and it's an easy little kind of club gift. But I think it's symbolic in a way that, and listen, I know you go back decades and decades, you know, everyone went to the football in their full suit and shirt and tie. That's not really what I mean. In 1987, that doesn't mean what it meant in 1938 or whatever, right? This is aspirational and it is, there is something of the yuppie about that. And yeah, I think it speaks to quite a lot. Anyway, let's get back
well,
to...
Well, also there's one other thing, and this was my motivation, is you're putting money into Rangers to get a better team in the park.
Yeah.
And the team that is playing on the park in 1989 is better than the team that was in the park in 1981 by a country mile. And at that point, as a young guy, not married, whatever, and just got a job, reasonably good job, and it was a no-brainer. Because it was... You might have had all the banter and the great trips in the bus, absolutely. But you didn't have anybody laughing at you now.
Yeah.
We were the kings of the hill, and it was phenomenal.
Let's get back to the...
It was intoxicating.
Yeah, let's get back to the actual football then. Because as much as the true blue voices out in the street were maybe at odds with one another, don't forget there's some true blue voices in that Rangers dressing room. Johnson arrived with the Rangers manager by helicopter to Il Choco, where pre-season was now a fixture. And of course, as many people know, the Rangers squad kind of sat at a big long table. And there was a solitary place for Johnson in the corner with bread and water. Jimmy Bell refused to set out Johnson's kit every morning, meaning he had to walk down from his hotel room to get his gear each day. And it's a bit contentious as to how much of this was just kind of dressing room ribbing and, you know, good-natured, let's use the word, banter. Again, Souness is inconsistent, as he always is, and he's writing in that diary, he says, you know, I wish the fans who have protested could have seen that. This is Johnson's introduction. These players know that we have signed a class act, that's all that matters to them, and really it's all that should matter to anyone. But then, years later in his autobiography, he said, I remembered some died in the Will Rangers players and the squad would have nothing to do with him when he first arrived. One flashpoint, there was a proposed photo op with some English Rangers players and some Scottish Rangers players with Johnson. And the English players, Butcher, Wilkins, being two of them, yep, sure, no problem. Scottish players would have nothing to do with it. Which Butcher felt a bit aggrieved about. So, well, I've heard since I've got here that, you know, the intolerance, the obsessiveness, the narrow-mindedness is far worse on the other side than it is here, but yet we can't even stand as a team, or a, you know, small part of a team for a photo op. McCoy explained years later, so there's nothing to do with Johnson. I'm his friend, been international teammates for a while, but I'd heard that feelings were running high. I didn't want some maniac putting a brick through my mum's window. That's kind of how it was. Mark Walters is interesting on it, talking about Ian Ferguson and his reaction. He said, I remember Ian slaughtering him on a number of occasions at training. Was it banter? I'd like to think so, but only Ian would be able to answer that. But, you know, it was a huge impact. As I said, players had to get their cars checked for bombs when they turned up at Ibrox. The training ground perimeter had to be checked for snipers. It was absolute madness. Johnson laughed it off, Richard Gough said. Moe was the centre of attention. He was the most talked about player in the country, and that was the way he liked it. Let's not forget the other signing, Andy. On the same day that Celtic officially pulled out of the Johnson deal, Rangers paraded their latest big money signing, which of course was Trevor Stephen. Another thing to think about here on the Stephen one, Trevor Stephen's out of contract, but this is before Jean-Marc Bonsman changed the world. And the price then for players that were out of contract, because you couldn't really agree with a club, or you didn't need to agree with a club because they're out of contract, but the club still held the registration, it would be fixed by a transfer tribunal, who at a later date would set the actual fee for the player. So you'd have them, but you didn't know exactly how much it was going to cost. This, by the way, was the only time Souness gave any credit to Alan Montgomery, who was the CEO. He said he played a blinder that day. Everton wanted something like £4 million for Trevor Stephen, and the eventual price was 1.525. A good bit of business there. But again, another quality English international coming, Andy.
So I think the story lies in the evaluation Everton have for him. This is an England international. He's played in probably, a mainstay in probably the best ever Everton team. A team that would have been, you know, probably went on and went far in the European Cup if it wasn't for the English European ban. He was an extremely good player. And just as we'd spoken about Gary Stevens in the previous seasons about, you know, signing the best right back in Britain, you know, Stephen was one of the best right-sided midfielders in the English league, and he's coming to Rangers, and we were kind of getting used to it. You know, I wouldn't say it was downplayed, but it was a major, major signing for us, and I think he went on to show what a class act he was, and obviously Marseille and everything else came in, and we made money on him, brought him back. He was just a fantastic player, wasn't he? He was all skill, because there was no massive pace there, there was no massive power. He wasn't exactly, you know, a powerhouse midfielder. He was just a very, very cultured, intelligent, hard-working, diligent, but extremely skillful midfielder. A superb signing. £1.5 million was still a lot of money back then. You know, a hell of a lot of money. And I was actually surprised to read that, you know, Everton thought 4.5 was realistic, because I don't know what the world record transfer fee would have been at that point, but I think 4.5 would have been majorly high. So, aye, big signing for us, probably, well, no problem about it, but definitely overshadowed by the fact that Mo Johnson came that same summer. So, yep.
And Souness has...
And the way the tribunals tended to work, though, was the bidding club bid low and the selling club went high. Then the tribunal met somewhere in between, and both clubs moaned about being ripped off. And it sounds like, actually, they probably... Trevor Stephen for slightly cheaper, because Everton overhead the pudding.
Yeah, absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, and it's such a different job, therefore, for CEOs than what you. Well, CEOs don't really get involved in this now. It's obviously more direct to football, but you're not being a negotiator. You're being an advocate, really. You're appealing to a panel rather than trying to do a deal. And it's such a kind of lost skill in this, because it went in the mid-90s, but. Souness again.
That was always going to be a car crash with him and Souness, because I know, because I joined a company where Montgomery had been, and he had a huge ego. He was a good guy, allegedly, but everybody said they knew it was going to be a car crash, because he was going in to Rangers CEO, so he believed that Souness would report to him.
That was never ever going to happen. We will get to that in due course, but yeah, you're absolutely right. It was a disaster waiting to happen. But Souness now. He's trying to give him quality options in just about every position, which he kind of has, but maybe too many. And you know, the Rangers overdraft is approaching £10 million. Can this really be sustainable? Because he's got three, I think, quality strikers: Johnson, McCoy, Strinkle, and some of this width he actually used in pre-season. The three of them, McCoy's dropping deeper into midfield because of injuries. Then he used all three as a trident against Thistle in a friendly, but that was never going to be particularly feasible going forward. But it was interesting that they tried to do that. Also, though, you've got Walters and Stephen and Davy Cooper for those kind of wider positions. Walters was an absolute instant hit. Stephen, the new arrival, which meant... with only 10 starts in all competitions the season before, his testimonial year, I guess the writing was on the wall for Cooper, and he grabbed the chance of getting out and getting a which would be actually a beautiful career encore at Motherwell before the season started. And with that, John, the only surviving link to the last successful Rangers team of the 1970s was ended.
Yeah. No, it was. But, I mean, if you look at it, is it really unreasonable if you want to go on all fronts to have three excellent strikers? Because the law of averages says that at least one of them will be injured, and it's also horses for courses. And they were three quite different players. So if you want to be where Murray said we wanted to be, then absolutely the squad wasn't too big. It was getting towards where you had to be competing on a number of fronts. And it was just changed. It was changed days in every way. I mean, it's probably in context of what was around the best ever Rangers squad. When you look at Butcher, Wilkins, Trevor Stephen, Gary Stephen, Alan McCoys, Maurice Johnson, Richard Gough, Chris Wood. I mean, we're talking not just international class players, but I mean, just we must have one of the best squads in the UK, if not the best. It's riches I don't think we'll ever see again. But, I mean, that squad, I mean, it's no wonder we were all intoxicated, drunk, you know, just floating in cloud nine, because have we ever had a team collectively, not just a Scottish team, a team collectively as good as that? I don't think so. I don't know what Andy thinks, but I mean, it just was sensational players in every position, you know, genuine class. It was great. That's a fan, it was magnificent.
I wouldn't disagree. There was a tendency to get a wee bit carried away, but no, I wouldn't disagree.
No, but another departure. David Holmes, who formally left his role as chairman in the summer, and well, this was always likely to happen as well. Lawrence Marlborough, the kind of absentee owner, hands off very much, just let David get on with it. David Murray was never going to be like that. There was no way there was going to be big enough for the two of them. And, well, you know, he slipped away, I guess, from the limelight, which he didn't particularly enjoy, I don't think, at the time. And with that went the chance of, I guess, a proper evaluation, assessment, love from the Rangers support. And I think we lost something there, I think. But again, Andy, this was just never going to... It was never going to work, was it, the two of them?
No, I mean, Murray was far too much of a egotist, even at that stage, to have somebody parallel to him within the structure of the club. And so he went in to become chairman straight away. Was that the case, Martin? Am I saying that right? He positioned himself as chairman, effectively. So yeah. A very high profile owner chairman gives you know, you are the paramount person in that structure there. And I think that was right down his street. And David Holmes, we spoke about it before, about how well liked he was and how well regarded he was. There was only ever going to be one personality comes out on top there, corporate speaking or personality speaking, and that was going to be David Murray. So no, there was absolutely no surprise there that was the way things went.
Back to the football then. Has there ever been a pre-season as anticipated as eagerly since 86, I guess, than 89? The glimpses. Did anyway you go to see Mojo's early games, Airdrie and what have you?
Yeah, I was at all of them. I distinctly remember Kilmarnock, which was a weird Monday night or something strange. It was a lovely night, actually. Down at the old rugby park. So, yeah, I'd have been I was at all the games, but the Kilmarnock one was the one that stuck out. And it was decent crowds at most of them. I mean, it was testimonials, kickabouts. But at that point, generally at that point every season back then, you know, and it wasn't so expensive, you know, it was a bigger break. So I don't know when the Scottish Cup final was it kind of early May, and then you're getting towards the end of July, so it's almost, you're getting towards 2.5 months really of not seeing the team, no June, most of July, not, and most to half of May. So you got every game, you know, and it tends not to be at Ibrox, so you can get, you know, get in the bus, get in there. I think we were Thistle as well, weren't we? So that was a nice walk up the road. So yeah, there was anticipation. You don't read too much into these things, particularly into the smaller teams, but you just, it's exciting. I mean, I said about the squad and everything. It is exciting. Everybody's, whether you wanted to love him, hate him, you were sitting on the fence to see what he could do. Everybody wanted to see Maurice Johnson. Every away fan wanted to give him abuse on that basis. So, no, it was great. I mean, it was one of those idyllic pre-seasons, because the other side of the city, I mean, they've signed Jackanowski, Galloway, and was it Elliot from Pisa? Mm. But I mean, the and Aberdeen are on the wane by and large. I mean, people are buying, but the gap between us and the rest, I don't think anyone didn't expect to win the league that year, and at least one other trophy. But I think everybody had, well, there might be shocks and cups, but we're going to win the league. Just, you just look at the squad, you know, we have enough there that, and there isn't that much elsewhere to offset injuries, suspensions, whatever. You know, we can do it comfortably. And well, it's probably decent football as well. Not as robust as previous seasons.
No,
certainly with players that could handle themselves. But, I mean, everybody knew how to, by and large, how to play football. Which, again, maybe apart from left back, every other position was star-studded, you would argue.
Yeah. I mean, it helps when Johnson gets in the goals and gets in the goals pretty early that pre-season. And Stephen too, and the glamour friendly at home to Spurs. I was there that day with that weird air. What was it? The correct word for that special strip was a kind of NFL
vented.
Yeah, the kind of vents just to get the air through. So there are gaps there. But Rangers were brilliant. It was a great game. Spurs 2 weeks behind in their preparation, obviously. Stephen scored. He's allowing Gary Stevens to do the overlap work, get used to that on the right-hand side before he drifted in. And this excellent left-foot shot in the bottom corner. And this balanced Rangers team with Woods and the normal back four of Stevens, Goff, Butcher, Munro, Wilkins, Ian Ferguson in the middle, Mark Walters, Trevor Stephen on either side, and Johnson and McCoist up front. And some of the football was exceptional. Famous more for a flare-up between Gascoigne and Ian Ferguson, the latter appearing to spit in his opponent's face, which induced some chants from the Rangers crowd that would be in complete contrast to some of the others he would receive the next time he played there. But who was the first to step in to defend? The true blue, hard-nosed Ian Ferguson. Well, of course, it was Maurice Johnson, his assimilation progressing at speed. I guess the real test was soon to come, gentlemen. Flag day at home to St Mirren, that same starting 11, but St Mirren offering up slightly less space. Rangers easily frustrated, went for those cross balls. Tightly packed defence were well suited to them. And you know, Rangers went one down in the second half, early in the second half. Kenny McDowell leaping to beat Chris Woods to a rare cross. And I think it was so robust, even by the standards of the day, leaving the England goalkeeper with a broken collarbone. I cannot believe that was allowed. Ian Ferguson had a great performance at five-a-sides in training and goals, so Butcher told him to take his place, which he quickly regretted, I think, when he realised that he was a different kettle of fish playing in front of 40,000 people. But yet again, Rangers on the flag day, Andy, like 2 years before, had had let themselves down, and more importantly, Woods was injured.
Yeah, I remember this vividly because the goal should never have stood. Which was never really the same goal after that, to be quite honest with you. I think that's really the point where we see Woods decline as a Rangers goalkeeper. And Kenny McDowell was forever, burned into my mind as this dirty get that clattered the Rangers player. But it was total anticlimax. And we're talking about Trevor Stephen and Mo Johnson, two major signings. I mean, you couldn't really get bigger signings than they two. And we start off our league season like that. And we'd kind of get a name for being slow starters, and it was something that was perpetually annoying. But this was probably a real shock result because we should be dispatching St Mirren on such an auspicious day without any issues whatsoever. Particularly given, as you're saying, the pre-season friendlies weren't promising in particularly the Spurs game, despite, as you say, 2 weeks behind, Ferguson completely outclassed the big name there in Paul Gascoigne. So you're coming in this with a lot of hope and a lot of expectation, not just for a result, but a performance. So a major, major disappointment.
It wouldn't get much better. Bonnie Ginsberg, and the sign of Bonnie Ginsberg, my memory on this is false. I, for some reason, thought that this was a rush job after the injury of Woods. It wasn't. Rangers made their approach for Ginsberg at the end of July. It was just this hold up with a work permit. Now it really was a race to get him from Maccabi Tel Aviv. He did come. He played in the Skull Cup victory over Arbroath, but that league debut at Easter Road was less than impressive. Rangers fell to defeat once more. A 2-0 defeat. He was at fault. Definitely, for the second goal, he came out rushing to claim a kind of deep free kick before spilling it into the path of Mickey Weir. You can make an argument that he was at fault for the first, too slow to dive to Keith Ouchen's low shot from the edge of the box. Again, John, Rangers were good. Crisp passing, plenty of chances, just nothing sticking. And Souness just refusing to panic. I'm not making any criticisms in any department, he said after the game. Anyone who has seen our opening league matches would agree we dominated, we haven't had the breaks, and that will change. That's all well and good, but two league games, two defeats. I know, you'll say that Rangers are often slow starters, but this is taking the piss a wee bit.
Well, it is, but also the context of the time is that everybody loses games against smaller teams. It's not pretty much since O'Neill came. Rangers and Celtic, it's shooty in. Any drop points against non-Old Firm teams is almost unheard of. Whereas back then, there were regular strange results through the season. Losing one at the beginning, playing well, okay, second one, no matter how good you play or whatever, it's, you still haven't scored a goal in the league when you think the embarrassment of riches you may argue we have up front. It puts a lot of pressure on the next game, which we know is coming up, I would say. But I don't think there's panic. I think there is a degree of confidence. What would have happened if that run had continued completely, or another team had put together a run of results? You don't know. But yeah, as you say, you've got to pick up. There's a time delay in the criticism. You might get it in pubs, but people, not only have you got to write it, you have to post it, then it has to get printed. So it can be pretty quickly out of date or whatever. It's not instantaneous as you would get nowadays. Almost literally as soon as somebody misses a pass in the game, they get abuse. This would easily take a week or 10 days before it starts to follow through. Yeah, you might get booed off at half time. You might get, fullbacks getting shouted at, depending who, which way we were shooting from the enclosure. But it was a different context and nobody else is actually standing out as they're exciting. There isn't even a short challenger sort of running away. I think Celtic had a half decent start, but they aren't getting taken seriously. I don't think by us. If the run had continued, then you'd have said, "Oh, what's happening?" but pretty much it doesn't. I'm not saying we're stellar, but we begin to, and we're playing well. I think that's the other thing. You get a bit of slack, but you only get that slack because there's no pressure elsewhere. And signing Mojo has really cut off their legs at the other end of the city. They're still in that kind of glass jaw almost phase. They haven't recovered. They've got the Polish playboy. I mean, how you become a playboy in Poland when the Iron Curtain stills up does tend to suggest he does like her. And he was a good player until Victoria's got its late license with the Clocklands. But yeah, it's, we aren't taking them seriously, rightly or wrongly, actually. It's right, because you see what happens over the next few years. We aren't really taking anybody seriously. We know that if we click, even after a poor start, it's all down to us, more than ever. And, yeah, it's more the pain of losing. It's the pain of losing those odd games, Easter Road again, whatever. Oh, you know, don't buy the papers for 2-3 days, whatever. But the games are coming quick and fast. And, yeah, you are the champions. And looking as if you should be again, which makes a big difference.
Well, as soon as there, it would have to change. Well, or it would change, but it certainly have to change at Parkhead the following Saturday, where the eyes of the footballing world were on the return of Johnson.
John Brown in the box, Trevor Stephen with the outswinger. Butcher waits. There's Butcher! Butcher for Rangers! 5 minutes gone! A dream start for Rangers! The presence, the physique, the heading ability of Terry Butcher exemplified with that tremendous effort. The power beat Pat Bonner, and Rangers get their opening league goal of the season. Left post ball. That's for Johnston, he's onside, a great chance for Rangers. Brilliant play from Maurice Johnston, applauded by the Rangers fans as well he might. Well, striking his best, look at the control here, bringing that down in a flash, sending the ball wide of Pat Bonner, but also wide of the target. Butcher again winning the high ball, here's McCoy, this is Johnston again, it's a great chance for Maurice Johnston. Perhaps he was over-anxious. That's certainly not typical striking from Johnston.
Andy, Rangers get a 1-1 draw. Very good start with Butcher's header. The celebration is just pure relief, I think. But again, a bit of a sloppy goal that Jackanowski's allowed to equalise in the first half. It is all about the return of Johnston. The response is visceral. He misses two decent chances, especially the second one. Which actually comes from soon as loosening that kind of steely grip on the team, bringing McCoist in, a wee bit more movement, a wee bit more fluidity. I remember being really frustrated for him, and he hasn't scored in the league yet. You know, he's not in any competitive game, actually, after that great pre-season. Your memories of this at Parkhead, were you there? A bit early for you?
No, I wasn't there. I wasn't allowed to go yet. But I don't think we can underestimate the pressure Johnson was under that day, because it was massive. And this had been going on for months now, that the build-up to this, the first time he was going to be playing at Celtic, and it was obviously at Parkhead. So the added pressure was the first two results of the season, because I think we were bottom of the league when we would have been bottom of the league at that point.
Yep.
And that's an unusual place at any point in time for Rangers to be, even if it is only after two games. So there's pressure on all over the shop for Rangers, and particularly on Mo Johnson, and it was probably a bit of a sideshow, a bit of a distraction, if we're being honest. And I totally agree with what you're saying, John, about Celtic. They weren't really serious contenders, and we knew it, and they knew it. But they still had to be dispatched. I think Aberdeen were the bigger rivals to us at that point, if we're being realistic. And Jackanowski, who my memory is the playboy thing, but also the fact that He was really skillful, but he was slow as...
Yeah.
The probably slowest player I've ever seen in Scottish football. He was as slow as anything. He made Carlos Peña look like, you know, Neil McCann. And he managed to score a goal. And we rescue it. We do. And Big Butcher's, his celebration right along that stand side was something to behold. And a bit of the monkey was off Mo Johnson's back there because he'd not broke his duck football-wise or goal-scoring-wise, but he played against Celtic and he'd survived. And there was life after that game, you know. He wasn't going to get attacked. There was nothing going to happen. And I think that was something that mattered in his career, that he could move on after that and just play football, because that was gone. That big what's going to happen when he plays against Celtic was gone.
John, the reception...
I think it did him a favour. Yeah, it did him a favour playing them there because of their reception. It galvanised the Rangers support for probably the first game behind him. You know, so whereas maybe it was, I wouldn't say half-hearted, but you might get some who weren't fully participative of, you know, singing Momo Super Mo because of the it's there and everything. And even if he misses, you get behind your guy at that point. You could see he was trying, and we'd seen enough from it before. And I think actually it did him a favour to play the first game at Parkhead, because then they had all of that and it was right, he's our guy, we're getting behind him.
Any boos and hassle from the Rangers end?
No.
He's just like, total unity because of the situation.
They wait until the game at Ibrox.
Yeah. Well,
but no, that one, I do know there might be somebody said I heard it, but I really don't. Actually, I thought it was an excellent reception for him, because it was, they've got it in for him, so he's our guy.
There were shades of the Mark Walters the previous season where he attacked one of our players and we're going to double down in terms of defending him. And when you're in that position as a football fan in that ground and they're attacking your players, what you do is either stand by and let them do it, or else you're become complicit, or else you defend them. So I was near the game, but I do remember that, you know, I wouldn't say the fans were warming to him, but the reality was setting in that he was here, he wasn't going anywhere. He was going to be playing every week for us, and really we needed him to do a job. And if they hate him that much, then I think, you know, that helped him in terms of the relationship with the Rangers fans.
My enemy's enemy is my friend.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Exactly. That's the words I'm looking for.
There would be an international break following that league match at Celtic. Again, 1 point out of six for those first three games. That's the international break where Terry Butcher had his famous bloody jersey against Sweden. But Rangers returned to league form against Aberdeen at Ibrox on match day four.
Stevens wide to Stephen. Great ball inside again. Johnston for Rangers. His first goal in competitive play for Rangers. 8 minutes into the second half. A glorious header from Johnston. Look at the smile on the face as he's greeted by the Rangers fans. And once again, a superb cross to the right.
Finally then, John, the duck is broken. I spoke about this at the very outset. It's actually a very, very nice goal. The relief, the noise you can hear. It would have happened, I'm sure, if it had been at home to, you know, Dunfermline or whatever. But it's home to Aberdeen. Big, big rival anyway, given how things would wash up. But when you're into the fourth game of the season, you haven't won yet and you've only got 1 point. There was a lot riding on that Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, and we played well again, I think you recall. And it was the start of Morris scoring big goals, crucial goals in big games. But I don't know how many he scored that season, but there weren't many, because we didn't score many, three or four goals, but there weren't many goals that were wasted, if you know what I mean. He tended to score big goals at big times. And he was, you know, he was a magnificent header of the ball for a smaller guy or whatever. He could time a jump. And it was Aberdeen And even in those days, Aberdeen had a certain frisson from the Fergie times. And as Andy said, they were probably going to be our main rivals. So, you know, everything's stacking up. And it was a lovely goal. I think it was Willie Miller playing. So it was always good to get past him. So we're playing lovely. I don't know why, but I seem to recall that the weather was always half decent at this point.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm right. It was a lovely September day, and yeah, he just does the business and he's happy. You see, I think that gets it. You can't fake your goal celebration or anything. You know, it's instantaneous. Same as the fans can't say, oh, he scored, that's an OG, as some would claim later. Everybody reacts and he reacts or whatever. And when you're watching it again on the telly, you can say, again, it's that reaffirmation of he might be a Celtic supporter in the past, but he's coming to play for us and he's given us his all and he's happy to be doing it. And that gives us a subconscious buy-in from everybody, because the doubts of, does he actually want to be there? Is he just going to take the money and put, you know, not work his socks off? It's completely at odds with what he was doing.
And it's, Andy, it's a good goal and the only goal in a 1-0 win. We get used to seeing that this season from Johnson. You were there, presumably. Can you remember what the reception was like? That just that relief around the stands, I imagine.
So we badly needed a win. We badly needed a win, and it was against Aberdeen. And I think even at that early stage of the season, as we're saying, we knew that it was going to be Aberdeen we were going to be fighting for the league for. Just a word on the goal. As good as a header it was for Johnson, I think that was the first glimpse we really saw Trevor Stephens' quality.
Yeah.
And the kind of perfect ball. It was a great one for putting a ball in with a great shape on it. So no really a whip ball, no really a hard hit ball. Mm. But he just managed to put balls in from those kind of areas where he would get it up and over all the defenders right onto the head of whoever he was aiming for. And that made it relatively easy for Johnson, and it was a measure of how good Stephen was, because we've seen that time and time again for a guy that was, you know, a central midfielder that could drift out right. But I remember that the it's a normalisation process. As I said, the game against Celtic was one step in the process where, right, that's him played Celtic and he's not been attacked and everybody's lived and life goes on.
Yeah.
And then he scores a goal at Ibrox and the place erupts because Rangers have scored, and it's probably a secondary thought that Mo Johnson is a scorer. And I dare say there was some in there that were glad to see him score, because as much as we had Rangers fans that, you know, had it was a bitter swill for them to swallow to see Mo Johnson in a blue jersey, there was Rangers fans that were kind of willing him on, because, you know, we want to see Rangers do well, and therefore we need to see the players on the park do well. So I remember I was in the latter side. I was a young, naive. It was all about football, as you say, Martin. When you're that age, the rest of it is awareness, but it's not driving you internally. And I remember being delighted to see Mo Johnson score, because I wanted him to be a success. I wanted him to prove everybody wrong. I wanted him to get it right up the Celtic community. And he would only do that by being successful for Rangers. So every time he scored for Rangers, it was a dagger to the heart of the opposition, as far as I was concerned. And it was a great goal, great day. It goes off the mark, and it gave us a wee bit of momentum. Well, I say it gave us a wee bit of momentum. We never got momentum till later on, but it got us off the mark because we badly needed it at that point.
McCoys had picked up a wee knock, I think, in international duty. Kevin Drinkle would start that game, but this would be his last, soonest making a decision. Financially, perhaps, with the overdraft creeping up, but also I think in football terms, I think there's a statement there about how he wanted his Rangers team to look this season, the target man that he'd obsessed about since he arrived was no more. We didn't have one. But we'll see how Rangers get on without that and this new shape and this just new way of playing as this season develops. Thank you very much, Andrew. I know it's a big one tonight.
No, as enjoyable as ever. Enjoyable as ever.
And John, thank you very much.
No, thank you to you both. It's pleasant going back to those times. And yeah, I think pretty quickly we all got behind Morris. In a way that probably surprised Scottish society and disappointed them.
And disappointed them.
John, I'm laughing every time you call him Morris, because all I can hear is Sunnis. Everybody called him Mo, but he used to call him Morris.
I told you.
As if it was a mark of respect.
Would you the Tinsley doppelganger is manicured Morris at Ibrox?
Graham and John, going the full Sunday best. Thank you, boys. Well, finally, Rangers were off and running in the league championship, but the midweek game, the visit of Bayern Munich at Ibrox that followed, would provide a harsh lesson of our place in the wider world. The club was at another crossroads. Until next time, bye for now.
Podcast Network.